I thought the meeting would last half an hour or even less, and it went beyond that. Do forgive me. There was no insult intended. Let's see. Has Mr. Jeffrey left? No, he's not arrived.
He's arrived.
All right.
Yes,
I'm sure we can. And we have. Not that we need a quorum today. No, there's no such sense. I wanted to speak to him about another time. Mr. Bassett, Mr. Skosana, and company, welcome. Let me do the welcomes first, Mr. Anderson. We're here this morning to hear the department's responses to the written submissions we received on the legal practice bill. Just to remind you and to bring you up to date on the legal practice bill and its tagging as a Section 76 bill, we took this matter up with the Speaker and very strongly pointed out to him that it just could not be a Section 76 bill. There was an informal agreement that we should get outside opinion on the matter, which we agreed to, and we were referred to Advocate Wim Trengrove. We obtained a quotation from him, which was submitted through the formal channels, but the Speaker has turned us down. Yes. So I'm afraid, I said to Mr. Jeffrey over the weekend, let's leave it as it is. There's no point in, we've made our position very clear that it should be Section 75, they have insisted it's Section 75. Leave it at that, at the end of the process, it will be referred back. Well.
Sorry, what does that mean at the end of the process?
Well, we are convinced that the President will refer it back and say this is not a Section 76.
Chair, may we not be more proactive? I suggest that we ask opinion from the Parliamentary Legal Advisors.
Them who are saying it's Section 76.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Is the tagging mechanism the same thing?
JTM receives a recommendation from the Parliamentary Legal Advisors.
In that case, may we offer between us? I mean, it must be possible for us to get legal opinion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I'm
a thank you. So, since I got the microphone, allow me first of all foremost to apologize for my lack of attendance during the previous meetings on this deal. I followed the submissions, so I have to pass. But on this specific issue, if we go further in the deliberation, I think we need to accentuate all that which is about clients and consumers. So I think that this deal, at least in the way I would like it to come out, will have an aspect of consumer protection, which could justify the tagging.
I get the sense that you've been in cahoots with the Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
No, I can't. No, listen, Parliamentary Legal Advisor and I are not in the best terms at the most of time. But there are aspects here which deal with consumer protection. We're regulating a profession.
So you're saying, Mr. Ambrosini, that the provincial legislatures will be able to legislate on the legal profession?
Well, it is not the way. In certain, it's a mixed deal. In certain aspects relating to consumer protection, you should be able to. For instance, ethical standards could vary from province to province.
Why
not? Then why should what you're asking me, Mr. Chairman, why should consumer protection vary from province to province? And the fact that the Constitution allows for consumer protection to vary from province to province, because many people protect a provincial matter.
I'll hear other people on this matter, but can we allow our guests to address us on the submissions made? We'll address this matter at a later stage. All right. The best, Mr. Skosana, I'm not sure which of you are going to address us.
What?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we did distribute last week. I don't know whether members got it. It might be a useful document. It's the Attorneys Act of 1979, the Admission of Advocates Act of 1964, the Right of Appearance in Courts Act 1995. I think there was another one I can't recall. If members want to refer to the existing legislation, then yesterday we distributed a document. It's quite a lengthy document dealing with the submissions. We've structured it in the way we normally do, clause by clause. And right at the end of the document, there's some general comments that were made by various commentators. So it's divided up into two sections, one going clause by clause, and then at the end, general observations that were made by people. Chair, I don't know how you want us to deal with this. Do we start at the beginning and work through it, or do we possibly have a look at the big ticket issues? Big principles that are involved and start with those. Lots of the comments are of a technical nature, so we are in your hands. Chair, I must also just confess we haven't, and with all the best will in the world, and you can lay the blame on me, but I still need to do a bit of work on the last chapter. I haven't got around to that. We haven't been able to do that. I'm sorry.
May I indicate a preference for the big ticket issue?
Okay.
Because we'll cut through a lot of the difficulties if we start to find a common view on the architecture, because that's what it boils down to.
Honourable members, are you okay with that?
Yes.
The big ticket issues, the major issues, the key issues, rather than for Mr. Bassett and his son to go through every single issue that's put down in the table one. All right. Let's go that way.
Thank you, Chair, and I remember. We thought that we could unpack them in the manner in which the bid is structured, even in the manner in which the clause follow each other. And we can either leave them now or we can leave them as we go along. The first principle which we thought we could converge with this Honourable House is the one which finds resonance within the preamble of the bill and the objective clause that deals with the independence of the profession. And then that will basically flow to the next principle, the governance framework of the profession. There have been views and inputs that although in the preamble there are some good ways that seek to convey that the bill gives effect to the independence of the profession. That does not translate in so many ways as we read throughout the bill itself. So we thought we could start with that principle. Say that one, the preamble indicates the main purpose of the bill as being that of promoting and enhancing the independence of the profession. And secondly, of promoting and enhancing access to justice. That's a broad principle that we need to be discussed. Now we are not some of the submissions here suggest that some extra work may have to be further set around that angle, and will then be guided on how we can put it. We have thought that as a first principle, as a first approach, we could basically give cognizance to the instrument that seeks to promote the independence of the profession, as they have been said, the Constitution, move from that principle, go to the governance structure, the legal practice bill. And once we've dealt with those two, then can go to the other, the fee structure, the regional council, whatever. But we thought we can enumerate them as we go along the bill, etc. Now, from the framework, the first one, the independence of the profession.
If we unpack that, and maybe I'm skipping or going too far forward, but one of the big issues under independence would be the ministerial appointees, the so-called ministerial appointees. And that is in Clause 7 of the bill, which deals with the composition of the council. And lots of the inputs that were made, comments that were made, were to the effect that the power of the minister to appoint members to the council would impact negatively on the independence of the legal profession. And perhaps if I take you, I think it's on page 14 of your document, if the printout is the same as ours, clause 7, and we're not going to be long in our response in this regard. I will set out what is contained in the document, and then my colleagues can assist further. The council is a council of 21 members. Out of those 21, three are appointed by the minister. Our position is that government has a duty to promote the public interest in certain respects in this bill. I would like to jump to clause 12 of the bill, and just keep this in mind. Clause 12 of the bill deals with vacation of office, and it says a member of the council must vacate his or her office on account of, and it sets out a whole range of issues. That's paragraph E. A member of the council must vacate his or her office on account of engaging in any activity that, in the opinion of the council, undermines the integrity of the council. So let's just keep that in mind. If there is a person on the council, let's say the minister's appointee, that undermines the integrity of the council, that person can be removed from the council. One of the mandates of the council is to preserve and uphold the independence of the legal profession and to enhance and maintain the integrity and status of the legal profession. That's set out in clause 5. Chair, that's just sort of by way of introduction. If there is this concern that the minister's appointees are going to impact negatively on the independence of the commission, bearing in mind that there's only 3 out of 21, a possibility that we put forward for the committee's consideration is to have a look at the ACASA Act, Section 6 there. one could have a look at building some of those features of the Section 6 into the ACASA Act.
The ACASA working, sorry.
Which says that appointees may not be public servants, they may not be the holders of any other remunerated position under the state. They may not be members of parliament or any other similar legislature. They may not be office bearers or employees of any party, movement, or organization of a party political nature. And they may not be persons who have at any time been removed from an office of trust on account of misconduct. So that, in a nutshell, is just to sum up what some thoughts that we as a department have on this. I'd ask my colleagues, they might want to add to that. Thank you.
Yes. From the comments, members realize that there are very various comments that Mr. Lawrence, Mr. I.J. Smart feel that any ministerial institution will weaken the independence and will perpetuate these controls. Nael does not have any challenge with the nominee of the legal representation. Disaster Center says law clinics must be brought at once to be added to include law clinics at the university. UNISA say competent persons should be appointed and not political figures with the right connection. Hence, we say that obviously, if you look at a class dispensation, which basically indicates who are the people who are eligible, who are not public servants, who are appointed through a public participation process, where does an advert, where people are called to make themselves available, where does an evaluation process, that basically removes the fear that there may be some connection between the minister and those people. Because if current leaders of state, where the people come from, they are just nominees by the minister. So we have thought that instead of removing it completely, let's put measures which can kind of safeguard those nominees. The Law Society of South Africa believe that there should be no members of the council appointed by the minister. And PSA. No, and PSA argue that they should lose members.
Yeah.
Now, the basic principle, honorable members, is that any other person appointed to the council is at the expense is to ensure and safeguard public interest. Currently, there are bodies, there are structures, which does not involve any members of the public, which only involves the profession. Now, obviously, nothing stops voluntary associations to include them if they want them, if they had the interest of advocating for public interest. GCD is not established in terms of any law. So if there was an intention to advance and to represent the people's views, and if there was a progressive thought already from the beginning, it would not have been necessary to prescribe it in the act. Now, to leave it now to the profession, that the profession must go and find a way of the public interest when they never want to get initiated on their side, it's going to be cut too thin. And the only person, and we said to some of the colleagues, some of the people from the profession, said, tell us who, other than the minister, who can represent that functionary must bring other people. The minister plays a facilitative role. He's a member of parliament, responsible for the of justice. The legal profession constitutes part of that mean of justice. It's not, as I said, we use the president for example to do the nomination. The legal profession is far removed from the president. The JSC is closely connected with the president because that was the president on the appointment of judges. The president has got no close connection with the legal profession, save that he or she will also be before court and will also benefit from the service of the profession. So we think that the minister is the closest functionary that can facilitate, that can invite people to make nominees, that can evaluate the assessment, and that can put people there. And while the minister is there, that's the end of the story. There's no connection. They are not state employees, they are not from the department, and they've been through a transparent process, and they serve under the council, under the chairman of the council. They won't be shuffling between the council in Victoria and the minister's office in Surrey building. There's no reason for doing that. Hence, we think that the principle that there be ministerial nominees or people within government interest, public interest, be retained. And then the committee looks at how do we balance checks and balances to ensure that there's no overcheat from the minister's side. Thank you.
I would like to propose now for our further consideration the same solution to the problem of independence that I raised in the first day of the public hearing. And it is the following. Before I state it, let me just acknowledge a few things. I acknowledge a state interest in certain matters, for example, fees and unaffordability. I acknowledge the fact that there are only three ministerial appointees out of 21 here. I acknowledge the fact that in comparative foreign jurisdictions, comparable bodies have a majority of ministerial appointees, and that has never been the issue. All of that I acknowledge. But it is the case, as has been argued by Judge Cheskelson, don't forget, quite apart from all the bar counsels and individual lawyers, it is also Judge Cheskelson who has argued against the fact that the minister is a presidential choice and just the ombudsman is a ministerial choice. He, as the others, have argued for the independence of the professions because they form part and parcel of the judicial order. So here's the solution. The solution, quite simply, is to substitute the minister with the judiciary. And I think it cuts through all of the difficulties. Everybody acknowledges that lawyers are officers of court, that their professional regulation would very properly sit in the hands of the judges, who already confirm and finally rule on their disciplinary issues and so forth. And the instrumentality that we could use is one, we could possibly use the Chief Justice's office, but two, in the bill that Advocate Bassett is still drafting, the one dealing with the independent administration of the courts, he may or may not, he'll tell us, be constructing the judicial council that Judge former CJ Corbell wanted. The Judicial Council would be a body that sets judicial policy. It obviously includes the minister, because the state does have an interest, but it would be a council of judges. Now, if we're creating such a thing, even if we're not creating such a thing, maybe we should, alternatively to the Chief Justice's office, if that became the body to appoint the three fit and proper persons now appointed by the minister, or even two of the three, then I think we take the sting out of the whole difficulty. Likewise, in the case of the ombudsman, let the judges appoint the ombudsman. Then the whole sting is taken out of the independence question. I'll stop there, except to say that I don't necessarily agree with the rest of the breakdown of the council. For example, if we say with this kind of approach, there should be parity between attorneys and advocates. This may not, anyway, not be the appropriate architecture. The architecture here is that the professionals themselves, by vast majority, regulate. And we may want to look at the alternative, which is the British model, in which your frontline regulators are not the bar councils and the LSSA, but new bodies called the BSB, the bar something or other, and the attorneys have their own regulator. Beneath them, the old bodies, the bar councils, remain because they have split representation and regulation. You can't regulate yourself through your own representative body. So the architecture, in my mind, is not concluded, but my simple proposal is take this thing out of the whole independence issue, put these appointments in the hands of the judges.
Steve Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the submission by Ms. Deans might make a lot of sense, and it's something that we need to consider as we're going along the route. I also appreciate the fact that the composition of the council initially, I think most of, if not all, of the council members were ministerial appointees in terms of the first draft, and we've come a long way from then. So one could, when one comes to 7.1c, look at the CJ appointing those or all of them or the minister one. It depends on what route we follow. We're going to when we debate on these issues, I think it's we need to look very carefully at this. And of course, this tying into this principle will then be the part of the dissolution of the council as well, which will be the next aspect we will be discussing, which we've got quite serious concerns about. So I think, Chair, at this stage, I also have concerns about the broader composition of the council, the 10 practicing attorneys and 6 practicing advocates. I just wanted to ask a question. What does it mean, 7.2, that consideration must be given to, because that is also used in the Constitution. And if I'm correct in assuming that you consider, for example, whether there is a disabled person to be appointed, and you bear that in mind with the nomination. Does it mean that you have to comply? It purely means, as I understand it, is you consider it. And you think about it, you apply your minds to it, and you move on. Because there seems to be under two a huge number of criteria that need to be approved. And if one goes through all that and, I think it might be difficult to find people that qualify. But that's purely, I think that my understanding is correct, that it means you apply your mind to it and then you move on. So just with those few comments, thank you, Jim.
Point well made, and it should be broad representativity.
Mr. Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to, just on the issue of vocational office in clause 12, I only see one reference to how people's membership will be terminated, and that is in 4, sub 4, is that correct? If not, can you point me to the other one? Because that is one concern I have. You're saying that, you know, one of the safeguards could be that we can remove somebody, that the council can remove somebody. But, I mean, is it envisaged that it's just the majority of the council that has to do so? And perhaps we need to amplify the process of that.
Sam Rossini, followed by Mr. Jeffrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually rise to ask for your guidance. There is something I need to say about this clause and many other clauses, and it cuts across most of the clauses of this bill. And I need to understand when is the best place to say that. What I need to say is against the backdrop of all the submissions that we received, I think all of them, if not most of them, have been made by lawyers. What has not been heard is the voice of the consumers and the clients. When we deal with the medical profession, we would have the interest of patients in mind. Here we are dealing with the legal professions without having heard the voice of clients. And obviously we are the representatives of the people and we need to make that voice heard. My point, that I don't want to rate it now, I just want to give you notice of what it is that we must consider very seriously, not in the interest of lawyers, but in the interest of the people whom we represent, to get rid of this absurd antiquity of a split bar and division between attorneys and counsel and junior counsel and senior counsel. If we are all equal before the law, so should our lawyers be. I'd like to make that point to the committee at one point, Mr. Chairman, and it is for you to guide me when it would be appropriate for me to do so, because it cuts across my input on a variety of clauses of this bill.
Maybe just to come in at that point, apologies for coming late, and I'm not sure where the correct place is, but I have a lot of sympathy for Dr. Ambrosini's argument, and am questioning whether we need attorneys and advocates. And it would be interesting to look at other countries from a British colonial heritage. I mean, America springs to mind, the United States, that doesn't have a split bar. I was told yesterday by somebody that apparently Zimbabwe doesn't have a split bar anymore. And it would be useful to look at other countries that have come out of, I mean, our heritage, in our, as far as our legal system is British, and they had the solicitors and the barristers. It would be interesting to look at other countries that have started with that heritage and developed and to see what they do. Because obviously the legal system, you know, whether you have an inquisitorial or accusatorial system is important. As far as then the issue of membership of the council, and just listening to Ms. Mutz's input, my worry is that if you look at the objects of the council, I mean, the problem with the lawyers, the attorneys and the advocates is that it's an old boys club and a closed shop. And I think the intention of the bill with the composition of the council is to open it up. And if you look at the objects of the council, facilitate the realization of the goal of a transformed and restructured legal profession that's unified, accountable, efficient, and independent. The issue of fees, that they must be reasonable. Promote and protect the public interest. The Chief Justice is not accountable to the electorate. The minister is.
So I don't think we have. I mean, she was just raising it, but just to sort of indicate my concerns that you know, I think, as you've said, in other jurisdictions, there's ministerial appointments far more dominating. This is only three. I would have concerns about changing it. We can look at the ombudsman, but as far as the composition of the council, the minister is accountable to the electorate to ensure the accessible judicial legal system in South Africa. I'm not sure that I mean, the Chief Justice appointing people would deal with some of the criticisms, but I, you know, he's not accountable to the public in the same way that a minister is, and only three out of what is it, 21, which is 1/7. And then on as far as the two, my understanding is that considerations be given. If it's the same wording in the Constitution, that's probably the best option. Consideration doesn't mean that you have to, but you've got to apply your mind to it. And then I think on the Schaefer's point on maybe useful, I was just trying to check in the regulations, although it's specified it's due process of law if it intends to remove a member. but we may need to give more detail on that, or maybe provide some regulations to that effect. But as it stands at the moment, it could lead to complications.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Chair. I am indeed in support of the whole issue of consideration of public.
Your mic, please.
I am in support of the idea that we should look at it from the perspective of public interest and involvement of the minister, taking into consideration just a little a number of appointees that are supposed to be done through the office of the minister. And which is why I want to actually support that view, that we should actually rather focus much more on public interest and to justify participation of the minister along those lines. If you look at some of the examples that have been given about ICASA, it doesn't actually totally make reference to the role of the minister, per se. So at the same time, when you talk about public interest, you talk about accountability measures also, and it's only through the minister that you could be in the position to be accountable or have a responsibility of being accountable to the public. What's actually also interesting is that even the groupings of the legal practitioners themselves, there are some who are actually supporting this view. And I guess themselves, they've actually looked at it from that perspective of public interest. And again, what is of interest is to take into consideration the fact that other countries actually have much larger numbers of nominees by the minister, like in our situation. Thank you.
First, Ms. Smuts, and then Mr. Swart.
Thank you. If I may attempt to contribute to this debate, the one by Dr. Ambrosini and then contributed to by Mr. Jeffrey. The history of this bill is similar to the history of the two big bills in the UK, in as much as the idea of fusion or merger of the split profession was put on the table. Mrs. Thatcher started the whole process, made some radical changes, but the idea of fusing or merging was rejected. Something similar happened here in the 10, 12, 15 years of discussion between the successive ministries and the professions. Fusion and merger are not on the table.
Well, I'm not surprised that they rejected.
No. Well, no, that point is taken. I think I've made abundantly clear my view that it is our role to serve the public interest, which encompasses both the position of consumers or clients and of the legal profession and the bench. Now, let me just continue where I was. Fusion and merger are not on the table. I would be opposed to trying to bring them in. In my view, as I have said, the case for unity has actually not been made. But I am nevertheless opposed to bringing in an attempted legislative fusion or merger, because I think that this process is going to be evolutionary. The modernization is going to be incremental. And I think that that is probably the best way. We already saw when the independent advocate appeared before us the failure of the legal profession to relax the referral rule has anyway resulted in 500 advocates who now practice without. And it's not good that that is not regulated. But they are modernizing. So I think that this is an evolutionary process, and I think that is how it ought to be. And just to answer Dr. Ambrosini specifically, why it should be split, let me just on the side of the advocates remind you what Kentridge said.
Are you on this side?
I beg your pardon?
Are you on this
side of the argument? No, their comments are to hand. By birth and history, I am on the advocate side, but I hope as a legislator I apply my mind fairly. And, of course, we have a number of members here who are attorneys. The matter of conflict of interest arises. Are you going to be like that?
Likewise.
No, not in my case. I don't practice law. I'm not a lawyer. I don't practice law. The chairman and I alone should be legislators. Yeah. The reason why the separate advocate profession serves a very great purpose has been very well articulated by Mr. Bezos, many others. Kentridge reminded us the rule requires that a member of the bar should not refuse to act for a client because the client is politically unpopular, etc. Whereas the condition of attorneys' practices are such that they can't apply such a rule. Their relationship with their clients has to be closer than that, and it's often a continuing one. They are entitled to have regard to the views of their partners. And all of this has never been more beautifully expressed. The honing of the forensic skills has never been more beautifully expressed than by Mohammed, as indeed most things were never more beautifully expressed than by Judge Mohammed. And you might want to read that on your own in the General Counsel of the Bar's submission. But he talks of the tradition of scholarship, the pursuit of forensic excellence, capacity for rational thought. And because they are not busy running offices, they specialize to a high degree, and that too serves South Africa well.
First,
Chair, I'm obliged to disclose the fact that I'm a member of the sidebar as an attorney, but having with the right of appearance in the High Court.
There you go.
Yeah. But let me give you an example, glaring example. There's no way that I would have appeared in the Constitutional Court to argue the certification of the National Constitution when I would rather, when I was the instructing attorney, and had them Trengrove and George Bezos and Murani Murani as the advocates. I think that graphically illustrates the difference. We did the runaround work together with the Legal Resources Center, and those expert advocates argued the case before the Constitutional Court and very aptly argued it on behalf of Parliament. So I am at this stage still debating the issue, but I tend to agree with the separationistness much speaks about, and that is fantastically set out in the book. So, Chair, that...
Can I just ask Mr. Swart, if he was getting divorced, did he go to a...
George Bezos. I think that's irrelevant. I think the point is...
There's expertise in the attorney's profession.
There is, most definitely, but the point is graphically illustrated by the fact that attorneys do the runaround, you do the preparation. And yes, there might well be top attorneys in commercial matters that could argue in court, and that is the exception to the rule. But your advocates are specialists in arguing, or erudite in arguing cases in court, and that is to be broadly accepted. And I think that is how it is set up in the bill, that is the intention to retain that option in the bill. So, Chair, that's just to indicate broad support for what Ms. Dean Smith has said.
All right.
Irma, everyone seems to have responded to a point I even made. I just took the raise or asked to speak to ask for your guidance on when I can actually make my point. So I'm going
to make it now.
No, well, I know that prejudice is usually a shortcut to deliberation. If one actually can hear the point, perhaps with an open mind, because this point has not been made. The consumers, the clients, the people. Well, yes. I mean, since my dear friend and colleague has put her colors on being on behalf of the advocates and of the legal profession, the legal profession takes care of the interests of the client. That's like putting the fox in charge of the chicken. I mean, speak to anyone who pays legal bills and see how they feel. And I want to make my remarks, since everyone here is destroying credentials. I mean, I have more or less uninterruptedly practiced law in the United States for about 30 years. I practiced law in Italy through my family law firm, and I've done some legal work in China. And here in South Africa, I've conducted the litigation for anything that matters, for the Nkata Freedom Party, the KwaZulu government, the Department of Home Affairs, and on my own behalf. So I do have the feeling. And we are here regulating a profession. And in other professions, let's speak honestly to one another. South Africa was in an insular environment until 1992, 1994. Many professions did not develop up to international standards. When the country finally opened up, the doctors, the architects, the engineers had the possibility of traveling, having exchanges with their colleagues, broadening their horizons, and all of a sudden, all these professions rose up to international standards, and many aspects they excelled. The legal profession is insular in nature and does not need to do so. Our lawyers are defined by the legal profession as it is practiced here, and there are many aspects to be a good lawyer and a bad lawyer. One of them is how affordable you are, how fast you move, how effective you are in your representation, and this has got to do with how things are done. And now, having practiced in three continents, I'm telling you, lawyers in this country are more expensive than in Washington, D.C. and New York City. Well, that's a terrible statement to agree to. I mean, you tell me you're all agreeing, you don't want to do anything about it. That affects the access to justice, affects economic growth, affects everything. If we don't address this issue in this bill, we haven't done anything.
It's
a very structure, because when you create a mechanism where willy-nilly a client that wants to take the result needs to hire three lawyers to do the job of one, you have that type of result. And that is not just a matter of hiring three lawyers to do the job of one. An attorney who one never really understands what he does other than most cases pushing papers. A junior counsel does the work, and the senior counsel who comes afterward and look at the work and faces it and somehow metabolizes overnight and then does an extraordinary performance in front of the judge. That's what happens. And instead of having a guy from the beginning deals with the client, deals with the subject matter, writes the paper, carries it all the way to trial in front of the judge and confronts consult with the other members of the firm. It's a complete different dimension of doing business, which leads to a number of things, not only three lawyers doing the work of one, but it's so a different take. I mean, I practice law in the United States, and I promise you, the pace at which law is practiced here is not one, it is one which would not be, I don't want to use the word tolerated, but up to the date, would drive people crazy in any law firm in the United States that I've been in, whether it's Washington, D.C., Boston, or New York City, or San Francisco. And that's my personal experience. So the pace is different. And the pace, the way people take things are written. They are affidavits are taken. And if things are done slowly, why does it matter? You until they charge by the hour.
That's
so
right.
That's right. And all they go to our bill. And we walk the comparison between the South African judicial process and many other judicial processes, that many of our judicial processes are much more simplified. We have applications on a much greater variety of cases than, say, in other common law countries, you've got summary judgment. So the actual amount of work that it takes to go from this to judgment is late. And yet the bills are much, much higher. Why? Because we have the system. And I keep asking, why do we have the system? Because we have it and it serves us well. But the answer that it serves us well is produced in the absence of a serious consideration of the alternative. It is the way it is because we are used to it and we have a level of comfort. The real elephant in the corner is that if you change the system, we uptake all the hierarchy. And the entire legal profession is a ring of the hierarchy. So, I mean, and we are all part of it. You want to have a legal opinion, you go to train go. You know, in this senior counsel and junior counsel situation, there is no such a thing as a lawyer, as a bad lawyer becoming a good lawyer by virtue of seniority. We have created a system between junior counsel and senior counsel which does not withstand reason or any empirical evidence. A good lawyer remains a good lawyer, a good lawyer at the age of 33. Then we all peak intellectually at the age of 40. Then we all decay. I'm much smarter at the age of 40 and I'm now at the age of 60.
Speak for yourself.
Well, it's biological. I mean, look at all the work of all the mathematicians. They all speak in their place. It is, you know, that's the way we are made. Giving greater credence to a guy just because he's aged is not a market phenomenon. We are alterating the market dynamics by giving somebody a silk, making it appear different before the judge. We are undermining fundamentally the principle of equality before the law. If we are all equal before the law, we must all be equal. Our lawyers must be equal. If I cannot afford being trained wrong, and I need to go into litigation being represented by my good friend, Stewart, with whom I'm not to be as much as being trained wrong, but he doesn't have the skill. I am at a disadvantage because you, Mr. Chairman, have the whereabouts, the wherewithal to retain this. When we give an immediate signal to the judge of a guy with a nice steel rope and a senior counsel and a guy without any such decoration, this is intolerable to the quality of the Roman Catholic. In England, they don't have a constitution, a written constitution. They don't have constitutional adjudication. Affectations, traditions are more important. There is a sour fair, there is a sense of fairness built in it. We live in a situation which is in a country which is hierarchical. Everyone defers to authority. We are trying to change it, but it doesn't happen. This is still the country of yes votes. This is still the country where the senior guy is more important than the junior guy. This is the country in which people look up and look down. They don't look on the level. And we are building this within the legal system. It is not in the interest of the people. It is exclusively on the interest of the legal profession. And transformation will not come from the legal profession, will not come from this commission, will not come from the Department of Justice, will not come from the high priest of the legal profession in the law commission. If it needs to come, it needs to come from us. And we are all biased. We are all lawyers. Okay, there is a redeeming court. There are people who are people in this committee. They are not lawyers. And it needs to come from you, the people, and the representative of the people, because speak to those who pay the legal bills. They are all paid up. And it will be paid now. And I don't believe in the notion of being an evolving role. We are tackling this for the first part. I'm not shaking your brain, John.
I can't be off.
My last sentence. It didn't say that we are going to
this is an evolutive process, it will go on, it will disappear. Now, we are dealing with this for the first time in 20 years. This is our last reform.
Really? Last?
Well, our last major reform.
For the election.
No, if we look at all the things, we have reformed the medical profession, we have reformed the pension.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We have reformed the things.
Now I understand.
We have changed the constitution from the old South Africa to the new South Africa. This is that we are now dealing with the untouchable. And we cannot let the hierarchy of the legal profession determine how the legal profession is to be dealt with. We need to have the guts and the backbone and the other male personality to do what is right for the people.
No, if you do, it's going to sit him for another half an hour.
Okay,
and you've already chased John Jeffrey away.
No.
I'm going to pose a general question. I've noted your hands, all of you there. I'm going to pose this question, and I'd like you to think about it. Before the advent of the Constitutional Court, the only people who could become judges were advocates. With the advent of the Constitutional Court, we said attorneys, academic lawyers, and we said, why not? And so it came to pass that attorneys, academic lawyers, were appointed to the Constitutional Court. Now, my question to you is, did the sky fall down? Did the whole system come to a grinding halt? Remember at the time, we were told about the dire consequences that we could expect. And those didn't happen. All I'm saying is just please think about that. Why did we do that? And what has been the consequence? I have on my list the Honorable Shope Sithole, followed by Mrs. Schaefer, and then Advocate Holomisa, and then Mr. Swart again, and then Ms. Philane Majake, and then Dean Smuts. In that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I just wanted to know how much time do I have for my lecture?
Yes.
Because we have just heard this lecture from the Honorable Amposini. I also have issues here.
I was not here for 3 minutes,
4 minutes.
No.
Chairperson, I will address myself on the question of access and public interest. I'm a rural woman, and as far as I'm concerned, the only person who is
please proceed.
The only person who is accessible by rural people is the minister. I don't see myself as a rural woman having access to the courts, because it needs money in the first place. It needs good English. It needs a status like Ambrosini's honorable. And it actually cuts away the rural people. And as we stand in South Africa today, you can count, if you will come across 10 in the whole country, rural women who have one day spoken to the Chief Justice. But a minister, we are able to. So for the question of access and public interest, I think the minister is the best. But lastly, I want to make a very serious objection in this committee that usually when rural women speak, people put their ways, I don't like it. I have got my own story to tell. I want to be given time and respect like any other person in this community. Thank you.
Mrs. Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to make a point and then counteract my point in the next sentence. But the point, I think we're going completely off the point. We're here to listen to the facts, to the department's comments on the submission that we've been made. We're now deviating into a whole discussion on the separation of the sidebar and bar. And I would like to suggest that after I've spoken, we stop. No, not really. But if we could confine our comments to brief comments for now and defer this conversation to later. Seeing as my colleague has unilaterally decided on her position on the bar, I think I should be entitled to do the same. And I willingly declare my prior affiliation to the sidebar. But I think the point is, you know, we aren't anywhere near ready to discuss that issue at this point, quite frankly. I mean, I think the principles that were made by Isaac Smith are completely true, in that you have the cab rank rule combined with the referral rule. Those are very important safeguards for people who are going to be in the position of advocates currently, to ensure that they aren't manipulated by considerations of attorney practices in the sense of clients and loyalties and so on. But whether you call them advocates or not, I mean, is not anything here or there personally. And I think we need to have a discussion. I mean, it's not, also not simple to say just because there is a split bar that it's going to make costs more expensive. You might well end up having a case that's so complicated you need two advocates to work on it, or two attorneys, or whoever, whatever you call them. If it's a huge workload, they will need more than one person. So whether, you know, whether that necessarily follows is not really logical. But I think we need to have those discussions, but I really don't think we should do it now.
Have you got all of me, sir?
No, thank you, sir. Honorable Schaefer has raised my own concern that a matter that the Honorable Ambrosini was mentioning as an aside has now been allowed to become the main topic at the moment, which is that of fusion. I would say also that while I'm supporting the idea that let's move on to looking at the responses, that the case at the moment has not yet been made for the fusion of the two professions. Even though, of course, they are on page 75, 76, towards the end of the document, organizations and individuals that have made this call for a fusion. I think when that time comes for us as a committee to talk about that, we should be in a position to have the kind of discussion we are having now. But the main point I wanted to speak on, Chair, is one that has already been spoken on at length, that of a person who represents the interests of the client or the consumers of the services of both the judiciary and the legal profession. Indeed, it is the minister who is in a position to represent the interests of the people, assisted, of course, by ourselves. But in this particular case, the ideal person to appoint those representatives is the minister, for the reasons already stated. You see, the judiciary or the legal profession encompassing within the judiciary is, I think Honorable Ambrosini has stated, the one of the last institutions that need to be transformed. By its nature, it is a conservative institution. And that is why it has taken so long for it to move with the time. Just look at simple matters like the boundaries, the areas of jurisdiction. They still call themselves the northern provinces rather than the current names of the provinces. They would have preferred to be called the Cape, Bar, the Transvaal, and so on, if it were not for the cause of transformation that the government has embarked upon. So we cannot, therefore, rely on them. The judge, the chief justice, is a lawyer. The other judge is a lawyer. They come from the rank of lawyers, of practicing and lawyers, and even academics, as you have indicated. So that is a club of people who have their own interests. They are groomed in a particular kind of tradition and and value system. So we cannot rely entirely on them, merely because there's this other important principle of independence for them to believe, for us to believe that they're going to transform by themselves. They can't. As you know, I come from another institution that has to be urged and encouraged and projected in order to transform. The same one is similar. On the question, which is the last point for the moment, of accessibility, of course, being fairly touches on the matter that I said you may want to discuss later, but the question of accessibility is something that we still need to look into. We're talking, for instance, about we're talking about equality before the law, and yet in practice you don't get anything of the kind. If one is going to be represented by what is called a senior counsel, another by a counsel who's not senior or even an attorney, or a person who's not experienced as much as the other side is, then there's no equality there. The presiding officers in some instances are even intimidated by the very fact that one of the lawyers is appearing before them is called a senior advocate. So that's a matter that we need to look into. The very fact that citizens of a country must buy justice is also something that needs to be looked into.
Yeah, Mr. Swart.
Actually, I think there have been many valuable comments in this broader debate, and I agree we get to get back to the composition of the council, but just 3 points. Firstly, about the granting of silk, and thank you to Mr. Panani for circulating that SCA judgment, which clearly indicated it is a presidential prerogative of the conferring of an honour in terms of the Constitution, and that has been upheld by the SCA. The issue of fees charged by SILC is a separate issue, which I'm sure we're going to deal with. But I just wanted to make that point that the SCA made it very clear that that granting of that honour is in terms of the Constitution. The second issue relates to the issue of access to justice, particularly for rural people. I think we are more concerned about access to a local attorney or a magistrate's court than access to the minister or the chief justice. Surely that's the heart of the matter. I understand that the comment was made in the context of the composition of the council as to what was more desirable, whether it's the chief justice or the minister that appoints the three improper persons. But I think the broader debate is, to what degree is there access to an attorney in your rural village or legal aid to do civil cases, and what is the fee structure for that? Where is the local magistrate's court? And I think that is broader access to service delivery that we need to look at. The last point about equality before the law, I've briefed advocates where they've been silked from the other side, and I've found it to be totally acceptable. The judge hasn't been intimidated, but I can understand the exception. And particularly in criminal cases, I think it's more pervasive in criminal cases where you might have an inexperienced prosecutor coming up against a senior advocate or a senior silk. And I think then clearly the argument can be made out that there is no equality before the law. So I think all very valid debates in the broader context of how we, as we are beginning to deliberate on the issues in this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Spilana Majaka, followed by Mr. Dyer.
Thanks, Chair. Just to indicate that whatever we do with this SMC debate, this bill, we need to just always take into consideration just the intention of the bill to actually help regulate the profession and also removing barriers just to ensure that access to justice for people of South Africa becomes possible. We have good legislative framework in South Africa, but our people of South Africa being properly protected, and the legal profession plays a vital role in that respect. And this is why, therefore, it's important for the legal profession itself to be affordable. And when it comes to inclusivity, I think it's good that that is mentioned, because when it comes to the council, it should be inclusive in the sense that we should take the, and as part of removing barriers, you should take into consideration representation in terms of race, gender, age, and something. That's very important. It actually covers the basic principles of the Constitution of South Africa. And accountability also, in terms of the bill, I think it's very important. And it goes back to the discussion about the whole issue of the nominees by the minister and who is more representative of the public of South Africa. I think that's something that you really need to take into consideration. To allow the legal profession itself to cut itself will be us really running a futile process. That's my last point. That goes back to inclusion of the minister's nomination.
I want you to just cover 2 points. The one related to the input by Honourable Ambrosini insofar as the retention of status of counsel. I just wanted to clarify from
the Dyer is from the Ministry.
Department of Justice. I'm new. I'm sorry I did not introduce myself as chairperson.
I assume that everyone knew who you were, Mr. Dyer. My apologies.
Fine. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. So there is no retention in the bill of any reference to rankings in terms of status. It might well have been something in the deliberations and the submissions at a very early stage by the profession, specifically the GCB, but certainly in the current bill, in the current draft, you see no trace of that. In fact, attorneys at some stage wanted to create something called senior attorney status, which also fortunately fell along the way. So just to clarify for Honourable Ambrosini, because he at length spoke to this point, and I wanted to clarify it, that it doesn't exist in the current draft. That's another issue.
Well, that's the issue.
The second issue for consideration was the issue of appointments, and I wonder whether the Honourable House would consider that the office of the Chief Justice could be compromised if it is making the appointments in matters in which constitutionally could come before the very court, and for the very basis of the separation of powers, the appointment from the office of the minister is a more feasible option. Thank you.
But the judicial council is a different animal.
All right. Ms. Smuts, it's your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Dyer. Point well made. But Lawrence must write to create a judicial council for us. Then tell us again whether that is problematic. But point well made. Chair, I just wanted to respond to your question, but I'll do that last with your question. But then to His Majesty and to Mario, who the King having indicated that judges are an old boys club, therefore wouldn't cut fees. Mario appeared to indicate a lack of confidence in the judges. Let me just say, it's a pity, Mario, that you weren't there for the submissions, because many of these subjects we have canvassed in depth when questioning people. There is in this bill, as you will know, surely, a proposal for a mechanism, a fee capping mechanism to control fees. Because it is the very great concern of, I think, the whole committee that fees have, in the words of the Constitutional Court, skyrocketed. And as the court said, they do not use the metaphor loosely. The Constitutional Court has also said that advocates owe a duty of diffidence when charging fees. That is the Constitutional Court. So I fail to see your lack of confidence, of course, is that judges will do something about fees. But look, the problem is this. We may choose a completely different mechanism. We all take your point that the structure of the split profession on your argument contributes to those fees. We discussed Advocate Owen Rogers' views on this matter at the very first briefing on this bill, who incidentally also says that granting silk is a license to print money.
Uh-huh.
I think he was quoting someone elsewhere, but he is opposed to this. So it's not Dr. Ambrosini that we haven't canvassed all of this. Let me just for your information, the fee capping mechanism, there were objections from the Competition Commission, which said that the practitioners themselves who will predominate in this council, they can't do it. They can't set the cap. There was a different objection from Judge Chaskelton, who says the minister can't set any cap. So the question then becomes, if that's the mechanism we use, and I know it's all for another day, if that's the mechanism, if that's the mechanism we use, is there a way in which a judicial council will judge this? That is a question, all right. But please, I think, Chairman, it is important to put on the record that throughout our public hearings and at the very first reading of this bill, the matter of legal fees and unaffordability exercises all of us. And it is perhaps, I don't know, possibly the primary motion, motive for trying to modernize or to see our legal system evolve. I mean, it is impossible when nobody can afford legal services. And that is not just the poor, it is the middle classes. Middle class people can't afford legal services. Therefore, the independence of the bar, the sidebar, and the bench means very little. And I said that over and over again during submission, just so you know where we are. Chair, to answer your question, did the skies fall when we appointed non-judges to the Concord? No, of course not. But the reason why we did it is we needed to create a court that was inclusive and had legitimacy, which the old appellate division was considered not to have. So we needed to create that court for that reason, and the old South Africa having been what it was, there were insufficient sitting judges to draw from for that court. That was the reason it happened. And the interesting phenomenon, although to this day the Constitution says that only four of them need to be judges when appointed, and in the end we didn't have it. The interesting thing is that over time, we stopped appointing non-judges. They are now all drawn from the bench. So it was, I would argue the answer to your question, is that we did it in order to have an inclusive by race and gender highest court at transition. And it's a clear case of evolution. It stopped over time. Judges were appointed. There's a lot to be said for evolution.
All right. We were considering clause 7.
Yes.
And in the process, we decided to spread our wings. I thought it was an important exercise, and I suspect that at some stage during our deliberations we will revisit the issues you've covered today. Nothing wrong with that. All right. We've not taken any decisions. We're simply hearing the department on the submission. Mr. Swart?
Can I just ask, whilst we are debating the three ministerial appointments under the composition of the council, I presume the arguments for would apply also to the composition of the board in terms of section 63, which is the fidelity for fund board, which also has ministerial appointments. And at some stage we would need, maybe when we get there, we can debate whether the same principle applies under that section as bigger. There might be a difference of emphasis there. You might want a ministerial appointment as opposed to under the composition of the council. But I noticed that that board also has nominations by the minister.
Okay. Alright. Okay. Mr. Skosana, I thought we shouldn't be too restrictive and confine them strictly to clause 7, but I think you've heard the comments and you've probably found them very interesting.
Very interesting, Chair. We have spent 2 years with the legal profession discussing regulation and governance only. And it was nearly a breakup point. We nearly did not have a bill. Simply on those processes, we have had many, many meetings. We have sponsored meetings just to get to some point. So we are not surprised that the committee has spent 2 hours. On the provision. Yes. there are two other key principles related to that.
Right.
When it comes to the issue of the political fund, when it comes to that relevant comments, as well as the issue of fees, which are on page 43 of this document. There are two principles that I think are also fundamental in relation to the governance structure. One is the issue of the parity of membership between attorneys and advocates, because it was made very strong by those from the advocates when they came to make submission before the committee. The second point is the issue of dissolution of the council, which was also made very strong that it might be seen to interfere with the independence of the law profession. Now, the GCB mainly and the Independent Association of Advocates of South Africa, page 18, they both advocate for an equal membership of the council.
Mm.
And before they advocate an equal membership, and I'm surprised they did not do that before the committee. When we engaged with them, they were advocating for a formula which will allow the fewer members to have two votes or so, just to balance the number. And we indicate that, look, that could be a very complex mechanism. Every time council would meet, they must then identify an issue. That is an advocate issue. If it's an advocate issue, then every member has got two votes. If it's an attorney issue, they retain that one vote. They said, with your respect, we don't want to stay in the court on the very same technical arrangement, whatever, having to engage you again to help us solve that issue. So I think now they are moving on the parity, 2020. The attorneys are basically advocating for more, because they obviously feel that if you come with a parity, it will therefore mean that aspects that are more close to attorneys will then be decided on that basis, where you get the advocates also having an input. I just wanted to indicate, regardless of the issue of maintaining a two-tier system, in a normal environment, that is not a matter, because you would want to find a legal profession that sets the standard for the legal profession. And we also have the same debate that within the judiciary. In a normal environment, you want a judicial structure, governance framework that takes a charge of the interest that pertains to the industry. Regardless whether you're a judge or magistrate, when people go to court, they basically get confronted with the issue of access to justice. In a normal environment, the same would have applied to a practitioner. There's nothing wrong advocating. There's nothing wrong law society electing George Bezos to represent them in the country. Because they see in George Bezos somebody who's very firm, who articulate, who represents the values of the profession. So they could not box themselves. And we have already said, over time, those things will clean themselves up. But obviously, the big issue is, how do you balance between a body that represents more attorneys than advocates, taking into account that we have 21,000 attorneys as against 4,000 advocates, only less than 1,000 of whom are synagogues, who have the loudest voice than all others combined. So, do you want the values of the profession to be based on the views of few people who can speak louder, or you want? And those are the issues you grapple with. And I think we wanted to sensitize the candidates to they look at that. In our position here, we're basically from the perspective of democratic principles.
How many
members? We simply advocate a process where attorneys remain in the majority, because they are the people who are more in terms of access and
who run the show in terms of profession.
But the case for unity isn't made. Why are they sitting there together? See, that's the answer.
If we have got the right of admission in the High Court, they also have an interest in both their own interests. That's what our basis
why we thought, look, we are not ready to come to a stage of parity, but we feel that overcome the normal environment, that distinction will not even arise, because people, the problem must choose people of high integrity, regardless of whether attorney or advocate within the country.
All right. Next key issue, Mr.
Next key issue is the devolution.
Right.
I would like Mr. Vassen to read it, because interestingly, as we're talking about it, we're also thinking of the necessity of ensuring that the same mechanism of dealing with dysfunctional council or board, because I know that somebody must go in the front to sort it out. If you are going to expect the ethics council to dissolve itself or anything itself, you will not have a board. There must be one person who must, after all has happened, who must take that responsibility of putting order back in the process. But we discuss that, Mr. Babu can declare your comment.
Thanks, Chair. Well, Mr. Skasano has already said what is contained there. I must be honest, yesterday our comments looked a bit different. This clause 14, just to give a bit of history, was put in at the very late stage in the book during the certification process. And as a department, we had our reservations about it. But Chair, the reality is that statutory bodies do become dysfunctional, and one has to think about this. One can't just wish away or just delete this provision. We understand the comments that have been made. We understand the concerns that have been made. But I think something has to be in place to address a possibility. And that's what our comments are about. We've seen it pretty easily. I think what we need to be about when we consider this provision is how do we put checks and balances in place to make sure that it is not done arbitrarily. The ombudsman role, the bill already has a provision in terms of which a judge plays a role, but I think that's where we are at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I share the department's concerns about this clause, and I think we're going to debate long and hard about other mechanisms. I think that this goes to the heart of the independence of the profession, and we need to strengthen this clause. My concern is if you read clause 14 with clause 5, which is the object of the council, 5A, facilitate the realization of a goal of transformed and restructured legal profession that is united. Now, should the minister at any stage be of a subjective view that the profession has not transformed sufficiently, he could then decide to ask the judge to dissolve, to inquire into the dissolution of the council. So I'm very concerned about the powers of the minister here, and we definitely, I'm opposed to the clause as it is presently drafted. We would need to substantially improve the checks and balances. I would prefer to see the referral of this process to the ombudsman. I appreciate as well that the minister's decision could be taken on review, and that there is a process here, but I would like to see a strengthening, significant strengthening of the checks and balances in this process to avoid any abuse. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. It does look to me, Chair, that the minister is not likely to use the powers he is being given arbitrarily. if you look at subclause 3, what is required to appoint a judge to conduct an investigation and make recommendations to the minister. And the council itself is going to be afforded an opportunity to respond to the consent that made the minister want to consider dissolving the council, which doesn't look like to me this is a threatening a kind of provision. Really serves to facilitate the proper functioning of the council.
I think, I mean, we do need to tighten it, I think, but I mean, particular concern was the point raised by UNISA regarding 14.7, where five members of the interim council form a quorum for a meeting of the interim council. So effectively, a small minority of members can hijack the whole process, and that is unacceptable to me personally.
Just a comment before we move off the council. There are two issues. One is there were only views raised during the hearings that what would be the funding model for the council, and where the department has done any costing of the council. And that's what we've always been of the view that the council and institutional structures must be funded by the profession, consistent with the principle of the independence of the profession. There's not going to be any sense that will come from the minister, from government, to fund those structures, and that will erode the very same principle of the independence of the profession. And I think that's the point which is being supported by the profession. In terms of the costing, we've said that the current legislative framework provides for the law societies in the provinces which are run by finances that come from subscription from the minimum, and it has over years built a very massive investment of the profession in terms of the attorney's profession. And yes, you know, they have built quite massive, Mr. Frank can bear you out on that. And we think that the very same model should be sustained. The profession will be able to sustain itself. The only question is how do you build in from what has been built over time, and by bringing over the advocate profession into the city. And the argument has always been said that investment that has been generated by the law society, they've been able to do so by regulation of the law. It was an occurrence that have been enhanced by law, because they had to have law society, they had to be a subscription prescribed by law, and wherever they are. And in fact, what we found very accommodating that there was no objection from the attorney to accommodate advocates who will come in with nothing in terms of what has been built over time, etc. So when we come and deal with the assets and what comes into the kitty across the two professions, the bill leaves to the profession to regulate themselves, to negotiate whatever. There's no imposing provision from the minister's side. It provides a facility process. So as a principle, there will be the bill suggests there will be the funding model be through subscription or through any amount through which the province can raise through investment, whatever, but it's regulated by themselves entirely in terms of Section 22. And the model that exists in terms of the law society will help them come with a basic costing model for the infrastructure. In fact, we have done some reports of the costing,
just to look what the law site is currently function, and what are the cost drivers in terms of premises, in terms of staffing, in terms of all the things. And we've always thought that this information that will help the council to get its foot off the ground in terms of funding. Government has always committed itself to fund a transitional council, which will discuss separately. Because the transitional council is a transmissive vehicle that helps bring the real council. There's going to be, when the parliament passes, there will be a transition between where we are and where we have to come into. And there's going to be a process of negotiations, a process of integrating assets, whatever. And that's a process which we suggested that the Minister of Justice should take responsibility for transitional council. And when we work on the principles for that, internal staffing, whatever, and the interim, we found it's a matter that we can fund within the current allocation. And because I think it was not very expensive for, it was based on 18 months, and we're looking at something that could fund these kind of meetings, whatever. It was estimated about 2 million. We're not going to buy property. We're not going to hire permanent staff. We're going to facilitate over 18 months. That the new council coming to be. And this facilitation would have cost us not beyond 2 million, as we looked at it at the time. But the real funding vehicle is for the permanent council, and they have the precedent themselves from the current models in terms of how they are funded. And we thought we wanted to bring that to the committee. As far as the regional council are concerned, there are two principles. The funding principle is the same, because already the attorney's profession have got the provincial regional law society, which are grouped in terms of provinces. So that can still be further elaborated to make sure that it further advances the objective of the regional council in terms of this. As the other big ticket issue around the regional council is the how that structure. While there's consensus, almost general consensus around the national structure between the advocates and the profession, save for the competition, numbers game, whatever, there has not been any consensus between the profession about the regional structure. They even asked the department to help facilitate discussions among themselves. And they were given time to meet and meet to come back to us. They had memorandum of understanding so they could sort themselves out. But what is emerging now is that there is a motive of adapting the current structural arrangement to be reconstituted as a regional structure. There is more eagerness from the side of the province to say, no. What we'll do is that the law society's will bring the bar as part of the law societies. We have two chambers in each regional council, one representing the advocate, one representing the attorney, and they operate on that basis. They only get the uniform nonsense from the national board, but when it comes down in terms of implementation, it retains the current structure. That, in our view, would basically not facilitate any transformation. Basically, it will leave the current boxes as they are. Those boxes are not open to allow any other people from outside. From the principle point of view, we say the bill suggests that the same principle that allow public interest at the national level must go to your provincial interest. Does not help. You go to the council in Pretoria, in the public interest, everything, but you go to Eastern Cape, you've got the bar and the law side, and the social, which basically is attorneys dealing with their own issue and advocates on the other side. So we suggest that the same transformation that inform the reconstruction of the national structure must cascade down to the provinces, and therefore keeping the current formation in a form of regionalized structure will perpetuate the current governance framework, will close rank, and it will not promote access, public interest at the end of it. But those are the big principal issues that emerge from the submission, mainly from the GCC in terms of the cascaded structure around the ground. And that will conclude the big serious issues around the regulatory structure.
It may be then just worth observing as it's the latest position of the General Council of the Bar. Am I right? Asked for, yes, the two chambers, for the national body to be turned into two chambers. It's on that point that Isaac must with the way from them. So the GCB is saying make the national body the Chamber of Attorneys and the Chamber of Advocates. I don't take any final decision on any of this. But on your argument, that then militates against what you call the public interest. But you see, JP, I mean, for me, the case has not been made for unity. How really is the public interest served by creating the National Council with a mixture of attorneys and advocates? Never mind the relative numbers. How really, really? I mean, what you say in the bill is, oh, it's for transformation and restructuring. You know, I remain to be convinced. I don't. So there might be, from where I sit there, we retain the split profession, we allow evolution, so there must really be merit in the idea of having the two. For me, I haven't made my mind up whether the GCB is right or wrong, whether we ought not to have what the UK has, create the new frontline regulators. The Bar Standards Council is what the UK has above the Bar Council. The Bar Council is representative. The Bar Standards Council is the regulator, frontline. The top body simply oversees, monitors, as by and large that's far too much, all that the English people feel, on what I've read. The attorneys have the, what's it called, representative, solicitors, representatives, something like that. That's their regulator. Below that is the Law Society. Above it is this overall council, the super regulator. And see, I haven't, in my mind, I haven't decided what looks the best to me, but it's that question of architecture is the one that, to me, will determine everything. And you say it's the public interest that we must have them all together at the top. I still don't quite see it, JP. I mean, the objects are what? Transformation and restructuring. Ensure the fees. Okay, we must find a mechanism for the fees. Promote the public interest. What does that mean? Regulate legal practitioners. I'm not sure they should regulate. Preserve the independence. Integrity and status. Advance ethical conduct. And so forth. Maybe it should just be a monitoring body, a nice cross-pollinating monitoring body, which makes sure that the frontline regulators are actually looking after consumers, are actually doing something about fees. So, for what it's worth, thank you for letting me say, but that's where my thinking is. Unconcluded.
Yeah, 2 points. First of all, I'm really confused by you saying that the issue of funding is to retain the independence of the profession, because you wanting to have a bread button on both sides. You're wanting the profession to fund the model, and you wanting to say how are they going to do it. You wanting to prescribe their fees, you wanting to prescribe the community service, you wanting to prescribe how many regional councils they can have and where they can have them, but they must fund it. I mean, I don't see how that can possibly... But to me, those principles contradict each other completely, because the minister can then prescribe 9 regional councils when there are currently 4 law societies, and 4 law societies are being funded. And then suddenly the profession is going to have to fund more, if the minister so decides, and then have the risk of having their fees capped as well. So to me, that doesn't make sense. And then secondly, I just want to know whether the department has looked... Isaac Smuts made an interesting point when he came, and he referred to, I think it was the auditing model, the Auditing Act, and he referred to a body of accreditation model. Have you looked at something like that, and could we have maybe get more information on that at some point? Because, well, currently it's abundantable. Can we have a look at that then? Because to me it makes some kind of sense to say we have maybe a council, so at like a national level, where societies, we don't take away the rights of professionals to associate with who they feel like, you know, with who they wish to associate with. But they still have to remain accredited by the overall council if they comply with certain principles. So there will be some kind of, particularly in respect of, you know, fee structuring and enforcing fees. I mean, I suspect that much of the problems regarding concerns with duplication of fees with attorneys and advocates might well come from the fact that the public doesn't really know that advocates sometimes do overcharge or charge for work that they haven't actually done and don't challenge it, and it's too much of a hassle for them to do so. Whereas if we have a monitoring body, then they can interrogate those things more easily and make it easier for the public to take those issues up. They can also then have a say in the community service, and if the associations then don't comply with those conditions, then they don't get accredited. So I quite like that idea, because I think that might... Could we ever look at the old Bud in the Bulletin, and why was that then taken out? Because it sounds to me that that may well alleviate the concerns of professionals associating with who they wish to associate with, while still accommodating society and the public's interest in ensuring that discipline is properly conducted, transparently conducted, and also that fees, that there is some input on fees and community service.
Before you, Mr.
Bassett.
Thank you. I do actually subscribe to the principle of cascading the model to the regions, because what's actually being suggested by the GCIB is something that's not really promoting transformation. One thing about this whole thing is that it's actually contentious. I'm sitting here and I'm saying you need a formula. A formula that will actually bring together the structure and the funding and the minister's participation together so that you come up with a package. Because when you try to discuss them in silos, to some extent, you know, there's a lot of contradiction. And I'm making reference to the whole issue also of fees, because if the minister has got stake in this and then he establishes, facilitates the interim structure, and then once the structure is in, the permanent structure is in place, then you completely pull out in terms of funding. I think that needs to be revisited to see to what extent it would actually be viable. Because I'm just thinking that if you need to have a say in something, also money plays an important role. But let's look at other councils, because we have also other councils in South Africa, and get the best practice models from other councils of other professions, how they actually operate. That might actually help us to manage to come up with something that's more viable in terms of the kind of experiences that we've had as a country with other councils too.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the Badlander, the so-called Badlander Bill, I can't remember the exact year, but it was a long, long while ago. I think it was a task team that was appointed by Minister Maduna. And Advocate Badlander was the chair of that task team, and they came up with a bill, the so-called Badlander Bill, with accreditation. It was based largely, to some extent, on accreditation. And I think the committee, I think it might have been said before, but just to remind you that, I don't want to say the department was going to move with the Badlander Bill, but we were having a look at that seriously. But at the back stage of the attorney's profession, they came up with their own proposal. And that is where the difficulty lies. As, there is the attorney's profession did not want an accreditation model. That, and maybe Mr. Dyer could assist here.
May I, Chairperson? Chair, in my previous day job, I was CEO for the Law Society of South Africa. That I might talk on matters that sound correct is not coincidental. The attorneys rejected the accreditation model purely because it would retain the status quo of the institutions that currently regulate the profession. I also talk briefly to the concerns of the funding model that was raised by Honourable Smuts of Schaefer? So the accreditation model is very simplistically the retention of the current structures and merely a meeting at the top of the National Council for the overall effect of what you want to create as a national unified legal profession. But the current entrenchment of the current processes and structures that exist, what is wrong with that is the entrenchment of the way in which the practice has developed. There is no magic difference between standards and ethics between attorneys and advocates, and perhaps too much might be made of that process that it's very different, and therefore we need to exist differently. There is no difference. You're officers of the court, you're professional persons, and your norms and standards enjoin you with the Constitution and your professional mandate. So you're exactly the same. The difference is that advocates might have greater litigation skills because it's their way of being in court, and so they're groomed in that way. But apart from that, the bill must seek to allow graduates to change between being an attorney and an advocate without any major obstacle. And that will enhance access to justice. That will allow your various persons to enter the profession much more easily. The whole issue of having to serve pupillage for no money for 6 months is bankrupting. So where's the issue of access to justice? Why does that system exist of master and servant? It's an old archaic colonial process. So we must ask ourselves as to whether we want to retain something that allows that relationship to be further entrenched in this day and age. And we must all unanimously say, it can't work. It doesn't work. It's a creation of a monopoly in which access to justice is hindered. So surely we must all see that can't be the way in which we must go forward. And so, insofar as the issue of the funding model is concerned, and very simplistically, what we want as government to say to the profession, we don't want to further break up the 4 regions into 9 regions, and because we want to do that, so why don't you put your money where your mouth is and pay for it? South Africa is probably the only country on the planet that has a system where the interest from the trust account goes into the Fidelity Fund, in which attorneys that steal monies from the clients are then protected by payments. So, and I think it's a very unique formula and a very unique system that South Africa has. But at the heart of the funding of the Fidelity Fund, which we heard about a few weeks back, is the primary role is to protect the public. But what it also does is that it funds the current structures that regulate the profession. So there is that funding model that currently exists, which will replicate itself in terms of the National Legal Practice Council and the various councils that could be broken up for ease of accessibility to everyone. So I don't think they should be concerned that there's going to be an enormous amount of money spent on breaking up the regional councils, because effectively they will have delegated function, and the National Council will set all the national norms. It'll do what it has to do and delegate, probably in terms of discipline on a provincial level. And if you look at an area like the Cape, Western Cape, the Cape Law Society governs the Eastern Cape, which is a big area, including the Northern Cape. Now, so it doesn't make sense in terms of accessibility. And so the obvious thing would be the spirit. And it could very well work.
They don't move at all.
So I hope I'm assisting a little bit in terms of that discussion.
And the most important
is the northern provinces. Is that like Haukang? It's Gauteng, Limpopo,
Northwest.
Yes.
Yeah, they just gave it another name and thought they pulled a wool over our eyes. Honourable members, it's 20 past 12.
Yeah.
There's a rather important meeting of the Rules Committee of the National Assembly. Well, there is. Debbie? Sorry? Postponed? No, I haven't heard that it's postponed. Well, look, that question was asked yesterday at a meeting I attended, and everyone said, no, it's going ahead. So you're not going.
I heard you saying a week ago that I need to discuss this people, and I can't find a way to find out what you're going.
Well, look, I hear what you're saying, and I asked the same question. I said, are we ready for this meeting? Someone else asked the same thing. Sure. Yes.
Before we adjourn, and I really appreciate Mr. Dye's input because it does give us insight into when he played that role as author. But we need to just be careful that we also don't. Was it LSSA? That there is a counterbalance when we do your submissions, because I'm sure the advocates would have a counter argument against the pupillage argument.
Very good.
So I appreciate that insight, but we would, and I remember us asking the two organized bodies whether they would be able to delegate someone to sit on our deliberation.
Yes, you did. Both of them, and I don't know if they're here.
It's unlikely that they are here. But it's something that we might need to engage further, just as a point of clarity, but I found the comments very helpful.
I
mean, it's all very well saying we don't want people to deny, except the fact that it is limiting as far as income is concerned.
But what do we want? Because it's not have any training. So what do you propose in your placement?
No, the thing is, the point Mr. Dyer made was that you earn nothing.
The conditions are unclear.
You see, for 6 months. That's the point he made.
The training must take place.
So
nothing here is a concern, especially from that side of the table with respect.
No,
sure.
We will decide. What is going to replace it? Because we can't keep lowering the standards.
No. I don't think that's what's being suggested.
Yeah. Chairman, may I bring something to your attention?
All right.
The chairwoman of the British Bar Standards Council, that is now their frontline regulator, which is between the top body and the Bar Council. It's called Baroness Beach.
Yes. From the aristocracy.
Thank you. Well spoken, Chairman. Chairman, I'm advised that the Commonwealth Law Conference, takes place in Cape Town, 14 to 18 April.
Okay.
That Baroness Beach may be attending.
Oh.
And look, she has views on how successful the British model has been. And it might be useful. You don't sound angry down there. But do you not think it might be of some use for the committee? Or some of us?
To
meet with her while she's here. In, are you not interested?
No, we can meet with her. We can meet with her.
Would you object if I try to get in touch with her and see if she's available?
Hmm.
And even if everybody doesn't want to go, some of us might want to go.
Yes, the delegation.
And come report back here. But you see, she, like many British lawyers, has certain frustrations with, their frustration is with your top body at the top, the super regulator. Remember, they are the frontline regulators, they still regulate. But the body at the top, they find irritating. But you see, precisely as was warned by British MPs, in fact, it's micromanaging, it's over-bureaucratizing. I myself would think that one of its functions is something we should write in, and that is, its job is to look at alternative business. The British have gone mad for acronyms just like we. I can barely read their documents. It's a thing they call what? A
L something. But it's alternate, huh?
Alternative business models, ABMs or ABS.
But that's the one thing, I think the barriers that people are that can continue with. As for the rest, I think some of them, the job is now done. So the 2007 Act, which came into effect 2010, they feel it's fitted. They are irritated by the micromanagement always. I think some of the predictions are the decision that 2000 would be yes, but in the but
hold on, good people. We're not done, Mr. Skosana, Mr. Bassett, Mr. Dyer, and everyone else. We continue with this process tomorrow. Mm-hmm. All right? Honorable members, tomorrow as well, we need to resolve the question of two of your favorite people, magistrates. So we'll do that tomorrow as well, okay? Mr. Munani, Mr. Romano has handed out the draft report, and we'll need to take a decision on that tomorrow, please.
May I ask you about this letter inviting nominations to the Human Rights Commission?
Yes.
Has that already gone?
That's been advertised, yes.
So what you're inviting is only people who are twins, who qualify. Portfolio committee records the nominations from individuals, etc., for suitable persons to be appointed as two commissioners to the SAML. Don't you need for two persons to be appointed as commissioners?
I'm going to go to the next one.